disabling his Twitter account and promising to delete his Facebook account. He's had enough of the peer pressure and he hopes other people will follow his steps. I'll respond to that later. The NSA is able to read the content of emails and Facebook messages. Earlier this was denied, but according to new documents released by whistleblower Edward Snowden through the UK newspaper The Guardian, this is possible. Furthermore, the weather is still sunny today with a little bit of clouds expected during the later this evening, and temperatures will remain approximately around 23 degrees. The current terror alert in the Netherlands is still substantial.
So. Ja. Hey, zie je? Ja. Will one of you be available to talk with us about Philip Agee? Hey, see ya. Okay, well, take your time because... Hey. Inside the company, exactly. Siel, kom jij even... Ja, ging hartstikke goed. Dan helemaal... We hadden het net over Philip McGee. How was your trip over? How was your trip over? Very cool.
So don't ask me about any news.
Oh, jeez. Menno? Okay.
Yeah.
Breno. Even de statische site.
Ja, wat was het ook weer? Yeah. Oh, by the way, you two don't know each other, right?
Eckersley. For the EFF.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay, yeah.
Seems to be that your website is kind of sort of down.
Yeah, that's not the website, that's the thing.
Oh. Well, I have got a high-speed connection here.
So what are we going to talk about?
Basically, the current state of the EFF, if there's a relationship between Bits of Freedom and the EFF, how it works, that kind of stuff.
Als je het opkrijgt, moet je gewoon even opkrijgen.
Ja. Nee, dat gaat wel lukken. And you're back to the early morning show. My name is Brenno de Winter. Thank you all for listening. Before we start, before the break, we were talking about, Cecile and I, about Philip McGee. And the strange thing that you didn't want to meet him for copyright protection. Now, there's somebody in the studio who knows a lot about the excessive force of copyright protection, blah blah blah. But before that, you were really interested in different different items in the interview and not about money. What was
it? We were very interested in the whole in what he had to tell about the Iran-Contra affair, like what he calls, it's the last part that's put on the site of this old interview of 92, and that sort of being digitized from very old tapes, so it's, you know, the quality is not very much 2013, but it's still very good to listen to, I think, because it puts really into a historic perspective what is now going on with Edward Snowden. And what AG calls a mass cover-up is the elections of the first elections of Reagan and Bush Senior. And how this was realized, because we remember Carter was also up to elections, that by then there were hostages in the embassy in Tehran. And
The whole October surprise.
That's the October surprise mixed with the Iran-Contra affair, because...
Maybe we want to listen to that first?
Let's listen to it, because it's quite nice.
Oi.
dit te luisteren. We are listening to Philip McGee.
Dit is niet het fragment waar we op uit waren. Dat is namelijk nummer 14.
Net.
Mass Cover Up is nummer 14.
En dit is 14. Hier. Sorry to break it off like that, but this is completely bizarre.
This is about stolen elections. This is about stolen elections in the country that likes to call itself the first democracy in the world. I think that's pretty saying. And the fact that the Bush senior and junior are still sort of clan-like in some kind of power behind the screens or whatever, and prepared the possibilities or even the impossibilities, I should say, of what is now governmental reality in the United States. What I want to add to what happened with this Hossidius and Iran affair, like 1 hour or something after the inauguration of Ronald Reagan, these Hossidius were released. But in the party of the inauguration of Ronald Reagan, there was also this infamous Italian guy in he was present there. His name is Licio Gelli, and he is a Freemason. And he was very much, his organization was very much involved with getting also this weapon deal to Iran, where there was this boycott for weapons, on weapons to Iran.
And delivered through the Israeli that now basically are fighting their
own. So Italian Freemasons and the Israelis and weapons to Iran, and then later Iran is the enemy, and, you know.
Also present our keynote, Ray McGovern. Good old, hi. Hey. You heard the story of Philip Agee. Are you amazed?
No, the October surprise was... I have the...
Oh, just a little bit closer to the microphone and you're okay.
That's better?
Yeah, lots better.
Hear me okay?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, the October surprise was real enough. And it was manufactured by Bill Casey, who was the... became the head of the CIA, Robert Gates, who incidentally worked for me as a young analyst in the early 70s and became Secretary of Defense later on and head of the CIA. And the more recent findings by my boss at consortiumnews.com, Robert Parry, have shown from the libraries in question, the Bush Library, that this was very real, and that Casey was not where he said he was on those days, and neither was Gates. And so it's very, very real. Now, the question is, there were lots of other things going against Jimmy Carter, and whether this was single-handedly the reason why he was defeated for re-election, that's a matter of speculation. But the unconscionable dealings behind the backs of the Carter administration, including by Robert Gates, who was working in Carter's National Security Council at the time, really unspeakable. I know of no precedent of that magnitude in our country's history.
Yeah, yeah. But have there been any sort of later consequences on this? AG talked about reports that should come out and blah blah blah. And but did anything of that come true?
Well, you know, this touched off the whole Iran-Contra investigation. And Walsh, the fellow who was investigating that, did his damnedest. But he was lied to by the likes of Colin Powell, by the likes of the various people, that he, Poindexter and all the rest of them. And the Democrats, to their great discredit, sort of succumbed. They had... Hamilton, who was kind of the guru, the go-to guy anytime the Democrats wanted to look nonpartisan, okay? So he helped to kind of cover up what really happened. And in the end, despite the really stringent efforts of good reporters like Robert Parry, the whole thing was washed under the rug, and they just wanted to go on. Why? Because the Republicans, in the person of Dick Cheney, who was the key on the committee there, and none of them had any, they didn't want to fathom, to even look at or contemplate the necessity to impeach yet another president so soon after Nixon. And Lee Hamilton went along with that. And they kind of discredited Walsh, who was running the investigation. There was all kinds of lies being out. I'll give you an example. Colin Powell, he was Weinberger's, Secretary Weinberger's military assistant when I was briefing Weinberger, okay? We're talking 81, 82, 83. Now, I'd go into Weinberger's office because this had to be done one-on-one. Colin Powell couldn't come in. And I look at this big, big desk, okay? And what do you have on there? Great big calendar, right? Now, what's the point of that? When the Iran-Contra Committee asked Powell, does Secretary Weinberg keep a calendar? Colin Powell said, oh, no, I never saw any calendar. There's no calendar there. You know what I'm saying? What the hell was that great big thing with all of the dates that was going on that day on his desk? So Powell lied through his teeth, and the others did lie too. And finally, Walsh
That seems to be really a specialty of Powell.
Say again? Yeah, he's really... So anyhow, the long and short of it was that Walsh didn't have the political support he needed, even from the Democrats, to face into this thing. And the press was very much against this kind of thing. And that was the beginning of the control of the press in such a way that the Republicans set up all these institutes, put all kinds of money into it. And the Democrats, because Democrats know that the truth will certainly come out in the end, didn't put anything into the infrastructure that would have been needed to counter these propaganda organs of the Republican Party. They sort of gave the field to the Republicans, and you know the rest of the story. It was, even when Bill Clinton came in and took over, he was sort of half a Republican in my view, and that's what we got. Thanks for letting me talk.
Yeah, well, and you'll be talking later on tonight in Martens and the Winter, the show that is going to be held in the Media Cafe, where we will not only make radio, but we will also make television. So that's a lot of fun, and you definitely want to be there.
We will have McGovern. We will also have Mark Seiden.
Who's so that?
Mark Seiden. He's this... how to describe him? He told me he has had like 4 or 8 careers in, mm-hmm. but that's like
Yahoo.
Now it's Yahoo.
Mm-hmm.
Security.
Okay.
He will tell something about that he doesn't think what is now being said about PRISM and the reach of the NSA to control. He will tell that technically that is not really possible. He doesn't understand. And he has been talking to colleagues, and so that will be quite interesting.
That will definitely be quite interesting. Who else?
I got these two people.
Yeah, I got Astrid Oosterburg, and she is a member of parliament of the Dutch Socialist Party.
Oh, yeah.
So that's going to be interesting. And I guess altogether that's a pretty nifty setup. Hey, after the break, we've got a special guest in the studio. Of course, you all are very special guests, and of course, nobody is less than anybody. But Peter and I've known Peter now for, I think, 5-6 years or so. You're with the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation for the Dutch, the US version of Bits of Freedom. And I want to know what they do with the whole Snowden affair, the massive spying. Today it was announced through The Guardian that the Americans do read our email, they do read our Facebook messages, and I was really wondering how they think about that, and after the break we will hear that.
And if they also steal recipes of good food.
I hope they do.
Hoe lang hebben we? Daarna komen jullie. Even ergens. Ja, dan moeten we even na een minuutje of 4 of 5. Hey. Oké. Okay.
Ik wil hem daar niet laten liggen zonder dat iemand bij is.
Hartstikke fijn, ja. Do you know anything about a huge global coalition stand against unchecked surveillance? EFF press release.
Figure out something about it if you want.
Well, if it's breaking, then of course, yeah. One minute, okay. Press release was Oké, okay, dan doe ik ook nog even een jingle zo. Nee, ik doe wel een jingle.
Better this.
Wat zeg je? Ik was aan het afspelen, maar ja, dat is niet. Ja, maar ga niet nog een jingle eroverheen doen. Dan gaat deze gewoon naar het eind. And you're back at the early morning show. Good morning, everybody. This is the Omroep 104.7 FM. In the studio, new guest Peter Eckersley. And you're, and I always need to look at that, the technology projects director. What on earth is that?
Well, that means I am in charge of EFF's efforts to build technologies. And I also have the job of making sure that all the lawyers and activists and other people at the organization are thoroughly informed from a computer science perspective about how the technology works, so that we know what's feasible and what isn't when we go in to fight for people's privacy or to fight for freedom of speech or for better copyright laws. whatever the policy issue is, we need to understand the technology as well.
Can you give an example?
Well, one example of the technology that we're building is a system called HTTPS Everywhere, which is a plugin that you can install for Firefox or Chrome. And what that will do is it knows about thousands of websites where an encrypted HTTPS version of the website exists, but is not the default. And so if you install HTTPS Everywhere, and everyone at home should definitely have installed HTTPS Everywhere, then your browser will automatically switch over to the secure encrypted version of the site if one exists. And there's a little button in your toolbar that you can use to turn that on or off per site. But basically, almost all of the time, you should be using HTTPS if you can.
And can you explain for the technically illiterate person why this is important?
Well, HTTPS is necessary both to provide protection against surveillance and certain forms of censorship as well. Unfortunately, it cannot provide complete protection. You're talking about surveillance. What HTTPS protects is you against the ability of a network observer, whether that's your ISP or some other ISP or a hacker or an intelligence agency, from seeing what's inside the web page you're looking at. If you open your web browser and you look at the page, there's content inside the page, and that will be encrypted by HTTPS. And then if you go up to the address bar or the URL bar at the top of the page, you'll see that there's a domain name. The domain name, unfortunately, is not protected. So someone watching your connection can still see what sites you are going to. But then the portion that comes after that, all the path, particular page on the site that you're looking at, that should, if things are working correctly, be encrypted and protected if you're using HTTPS.
Okay, so it's one step to be a little bit safer, but that involves a lot of other steps. One of the other projects that the EFF is involved in or was involved in is the Tor project.
That's right. So we sponsored Tor for a number of years before it became a fully fledged, self-funding, independent organization. And Tor and HTTPS are actually closely complementary technologies. Tor aims to prevent a network monitor from being able to see which site you are talking to. It aims to break the link between, you know, you sitting at your computer and the connection to a server somewhere else. But of course, it is no use to have that protection of who's talking to what if the content of the communications are not encrypted. So when you use Tor, you really need to use HTTPS. Now, this is actually kind of subtle and complicated, which things are protected under which cases. We even have, if you Google Tor and HTTPS, we actually have an interactive graphic that you can find where it will show you, as you turn on Tor or HTTPS protection, which particular parties or adversaries will be able to see what about you. And it's quite complicated. There are lots of different people. You know, you could be talking about a lawyer who goes to a company and asks for data from them. You could be talking about a police officer. You could be talking about someone sitting in the cafe with you. You could be talking about the NSA. And each of these different parties has access to a different window onto your communications. Using Tor and HTTPS provides the maximum protection, but it may certainly not be enough to defeat the NSA, for instance. In most cases, if the NSA is really interested in you, there's not much you can do unless you're an extremely sophisticated operator, and even then your odds are quite slim.
Then I've got news for you, because the NSA is interested in everybody at this point in time.
Well, it's true. So the NSA has different levels of interest. So, you know, one thing that Edward Snowden said is when he was asked about encryption, he said, you know, encryption works. But the reason that it falls down most often, you know, of course people don't use it correctly a lot of the time, but then even if you do use it correctly, the computer that you send an encrypted message from and the computer that receives the encrypted message, those computers are very flimsy boxes. It's very easy to break into a particular computer and install a surveillance, you know, a rootkit or a backdoor on that particular computer. Now, I think that the NSA, what they probably do is not install backdoors and they don't install rootkits on everyone's computers, because then they will be noticed. If you put something on every computer, then sooner or later someone notices that it's on every computer. So there are different levels of interest, and what you will get for the average mass population is, you know, a lot of wiretapping on the network, and then maybe queries that process the contents of the Gmail accounts. We're not sure about how often in the scope of those kinds of situations. That's one thing that, in fact, the United States Congress really needs to do, is provide better transparency about when a person's email can be queried across in the course of some curious investigation by a spy sitting at her desk in the outskirts of Washington, D.C. We need clarity on that question. But then there's a higher level of interest, which is once someone in Virginia or Maryland has decided that they're interested in you and they decide to target you, then you probably have no hope, because they will find a bug in one of the programs that you're using and they will get control of your computer, and it doesn't matter how much encryption you use if they are willing to break into your machine.
Yes. Now looking at your work for the EFF, this is the known. You also have to, Panopticlick.
Mm-hmm.
I always forget about the word, but can you briefly explain what that is?
So Panopticlick is a different kind of project. This is about more oriented towards commercial surveillance rather than government surveillance, although it's possible that the NSA is using the same kinds of techniques. Now, everyone's familiar with the possibility of being tracked by cookies. Now in the Netherlands, of course, that's a widely discussed and debated phenomenon, and being tracked by IP addresses, which are the address that essentially corresponds to the street address that you're using your computer from. And websites can always see your IP address. They can set cookies, and third parties can set cookies to track you. But what we did in with Panopticlick is document another form of tracking that was beginning to occur, where your web browser would be tracked by the unique combination of what browser, what version of the browser, what language, what time zone you are in, how big your screen on your computer is, what fonts you have installed, what plugins you have installed, what versions of the plugins you have installed. It turned out, we weren't sure. We heard that people were doing this fingerprinting thing to track people. And so we decided to do an experiment to see how good it was. And we put up a website, where panopticlick.eff.org, where you could go and you could have your browser tested and compared to all the other visitors to the site. And in the couple of weeks after we put the website up, we got our first 1 million visitors. And we found in that sample population, of desktop browsers at the time, at least 90% of them in the sample of 1 million were unique. And we were not doing a very sophisticated job of detecting this. I think if you're a company that specializes in fingerprinting, you will probably get more than 90% unique. You'll get 95% or 99% unique. And so what this means is that if websites decide to try to track you, there's really not much you can do. You can't delete your cookies. You can use Tor, but Tor has some good protections against fingerprinting built into it, but most people can't use Tor for all of their browsing. It's just not practical. And even if you do use Tor, you have this problem of the connection between your accounts, which are inherently identified, and then the things you want to do anonymously, and keeping track of which things are anonymous and which things are not anonymous. You know, it's a lot of housekeeping. And so what we actually concluded after the Panopticlick project was that if there's an arms race between online trackers and users who are trying to defend themselves, the trackers are going to win. There isn't a fair arms race, a fair contest between the user trying to defend themselves with software and the tracker. And so we actually started promoting a proposal called Do Not Track, a way of saying, actually, this particular browser has said that you do not have permission to track it. And if you do, it's a clear violation of consent. There was a clear statement, and now you, the company, have just said, oh, we don't care about your permission, we're going to track you anyway. And that's going to put us into a stronger position to have the users defend themselves, either by legal means or by stronger technological means. And I'll be talking in a couple of days at OHM about a technology we're building to try and implement events of this sort.
Can you tell a little bit more? Well,
one of the things that you face here is that the tracking piece of tracking seems to be impossible to stop because of these these methods like fingerprinting, which are just too, and there are other methods, super cookies, that are just too effective. It's too hard for the browsers to protect people against them. Google and Firefox and those companies have been unwilling to accept the drastic patches you would need to fix all of these fingerprintable things. So instead, what we think we need to do is have your browser configured so it sends do not track, and then it looks to see evidence that maybe it's being tracked by a site anyway. And if it finds that evidence, then it will just start blocking communications with a third party that's doing that automatically. Now, this is technically quite complicated because, unfortunately, you know, the web is made of hypertext, and hypertext is inherently a very promiscuous way of building text and software. And so you have all these cases where you see things that look like tracking, maybe have tracking as a side effect, but they also have some structural important purpose. They're there to make the buttons on the website work. It's jQuery, or it's an site-specific analytics tool or something. And so probably we're going to need to do some kind of sophisticated whitelisting process where we let the jQuery through, or we block its cookies, but we continue letting the requests through. But what we expect is that a large number of invisible trackers, and also a large number of advertising companies that just advertise and track at the same time, those things will get blocked by this software. And then the aim is to be able to do that without breaking user experience. And then to say to the companies, you know, if you want to keep showing ads to these users, because that's what the companies want, you're going to need to respect their do not track request. You've seen the do not track request. You've said, oh, we're going to pretend not to track you, but we're going to still use a cookie. We're going to still take a fingerprint. We're going to still collect logs of your reading history. And we're just saying, no, that's actually not acceptable. And if you keep doing that, users should start defending themselves. And if that means blocking the ads, then fine.
Okay. Clear. And when is your talk?
In 2 days' time, day 3. And if I get a copy of the schedule here, that talk will be in... I think it's in room 2.
No, it's in room 1 at 6 o'clock. Encrypt, how to encrypt.
That's a different talk. So I have 2 talks tomorrow. One of them is about HTTPS.
Oh, non-consensual tracking. That's indeed in track 2 at 11 on day
11 p.m. That's right. So if you want to defend yourself against commercial surveillance, you have to stay up late.
No. Don't show up. Just come to the media cafe, because our show will definitely be better.
Well, if you're into the, doing many things at once, you can come to the talk and also listen with headphone.
Okay. Yeah. Peter, thank you.
Thank you, Breno.
Thank you. Cool.
Man at work.
Yeah.
Melig muziekje erachteraan.
Wie zijn die...
Waar zijn die CD's die journalists? Van mij eigenlijk? Want... Is het mogelijk... Dennis en Jasper.
Jouw multicabel ligt naast de RS9. Hij zit nu opgerold als een liedje. Ik zou het heel fijn vinden als hij netjes in de achters retour zou kunnen komen. Ja, ik bedoel, het is niet dat ik hem nou zo netjes aanlever, maar dat is omdat ik straks door in.
Kun je die ietsjes... Heb ik nog een jingletje hier? Deze. Hey guys. Yeah, indeed, we are back with the early morning radio show. The last 8 minutes of the show. And we've got two new guests.
Yes.
Introduce yourself, please.
Okay. Hi, I'm Marinus Kuivenhoven, and this is my colleague and friend.
Martin Visser.
And you're both...
Security researchers, pen testers.
Yes.
Thingy.
Absolutely correct. Do you want to name the company you work for? Do you say like, man, let's not do that?
Ah, that's okay.
It's okay like this. Okay, absolutely. I'm absolutely fine with it. Hey, there is a whole debate in the Netherlands, raging actually, and that's all about responsible disclosure, security researchers that do security research, then find out shit and then get into trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that the current, there's a new proposal called responsible disclosure?
Mm-hmm.
Is it responsible to all sides?
I think the lines aren't that clear. There's like things you can do, the things you shouldn't do, and what's in between is just too vague. And most of the time, it can happen that even though you do it for the right causes, that you still get lawsuits or threats
prosecuted.
Or,
yeah.
What do you mean? Is it responsible to both sides?
Well, there are actually a couple of sides, but there's the government, there's the one who has the data leak, there's the one who discovers the data leak, and then we've got the public prosecutor with the whole police and all the powers that they have.
Yeah. Well, we see the public prosecutor could like play a different role in it, which is not really covered by the responsible disclosure policies that companies draft. Well, we're launching a new initiative to try and make responsible disclosure easier for both hackers and companies to implement such a process.
How do you do that?
Well, what we're trying to do is have contracts or some policy or terms of agreement with companies. So companies would really want to do that themselves, as if with the current responsible disclosure policies. If we would do that, we'd like to have some sort of proxy or some sort of technical means for hackers to use our infrastructure and hack these companies. And we'll guide the process of disclosing bugs to the company.
Okay, and now suppose, let's break it down a little bit, because you're giving a lot of information in basically 1.5 sentences.
That's the idea, right? We only have 8 minutes.
Yeah, I know. But I'm a hacker, and there's this company, the Acme company, and there's a website, and I suspect that they are not dealing right with data. Now, how does it work?
So, well, first of all, the initiative is new, and we don't have everything thought out yet. We just think such an initiative is needed to make it easier for companies and hackers. So the thing we see is that Acme company first needs to step up and say they would like to become more secure. We can't really force them to do so. So if you find some data breaches on a site which we're not involved with, I don't think we'd be able to help that out. If you would as a company and several companies do that and know should be doing something about it. If as a company you'd like to start with that but you don't know how to, we can facilitate that. We can provide a means for hackers to try and find security issues in your infrastructure, in your sites, whatever.
So it's basically a free pen test.
Yeah, that's what the companies will get, and what we're trying to do for the hacker community is that they have like a process or how to submit things, ways to be able to do it, like think as Kali or Backtrack as a service where they can log in and they can only access this specific client from this time to this time.
Uh-huh.
We can actually guide them, let them log in into some Backtrack system, so we can facilitate it for both parties.
Yeah, but I think it might not be the same as pen testing for free, because you wouldn't know coverage, you wouldn't know who did such hacking attempts. But
so you
I think the main point is just facilitating the process of responsible disclosure, because now we see it as a thing between maybe hackers that don't have previous experience with responsible disclosure, or more so companies that don't have any experience with that, but do have real needs for security. And that's probably going to be the first thing they'd realize, that they have a need for security, and then they're still miles away from having a responsible disclosure policy and handling such incidents correctly.
Yeah, no, but it will help, and of course keeping them anonymous, that helps a lot, because I know that's what a lot of hackers are really afraid for. So that definitely brings it a little step further. Have you ever reported a bug yourself?
Yeah.
How did that go?
Practically all the times it went pretty well. I think I have a couple of cases that could have begun better. From the company side.
How do you... did they ever threaten you? Because sometimes...
Yeah, I've gotten threats, but...
they didn't materialize.
No. But I'm more shocked by you submit something and you get an automated mail back. And then you try to get somebody in the company who actually understands what you're talking about. And they don't do anything with it.
Yeah, I know. I've noticed that as well a lot, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Thank you guys for coming to the studio. Thank you for being here and waiting all the time to be on the show.
Thanks a lot as well.
Yeah, yeah, and I hope that your project succeeds. You've been listening to the Early Morning Radio Show. My name is Brenno de Winter. Thank you for listening and thank you for being in on our program. You can keep listening to 104.7 FM and you can also call us on our decks 1047. And if that's not enough, we've got a stream radio.nifhack.nl. Thank you for listening and speak to you tomorrow.
Sorry? Dat was niet ons. Ja, even 1 seconde, even naar het nieuws. Oké. Okay. Six o'clock in the Netherlands. This is Omroep. My name is Brenno de Winter with the news. OM has been started and has been opened, and that has been done by Koen Martens, the organizer who opened the conference by disabling his Twitter account and deleting it altogether.